Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signa Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Have you heard of ketamine-assisted therapy? Interested in hearing more about what it is and how it's being received? Well, joining us today is licensed marriage family therapist Susanna Neufeld, who provides ketamine-assisted therapy and is the author of Awake at 3 a.m., Yoga Therapy for Anxiety and Depression in Pregnancy and Early Motherhood. Also with us today is Dr. Miriam Schultz, a reproductive psychiatrist with extensive experience in the field of reproductive psychiatry, as well as ketamine treatment. She is also an associate clinical professor at Stanford University. They both practice in the San Francisco Bay Area. Susanna and Dr. Miriam Schultz, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's so nice to have the two of you here live in the studio. What a treat.
Thank you for having us.
Susanna, I'm going to start with you. What is ketamine-assisted psychotherapy?
So I think that you could interview 100 different people who offer ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, and they would all give you really different answers. It's a little bit, I've heard the phrase said a lot, that it's a little bit like the Wild West in terms of the different approaches and ways that people are working with it. So, you know, what I will say that it's a little bit different from a setting where someone is just getting ketamine, the medication itself, for treatment-resistant depression. Ketamine-assisted psychotherapy is using the ketamine as a catalyst for deeper psychotherapeutic work. And this can look a lot of ways, but it can look like having the ketamine in the therapy session at a lower dose so the person can really use the medicine in the session to process things deeper. It can also look like having deeper journeys and then having a lot of what we call preparation ahead of time and integration afterwards to let the themes that have arisen in the psychotherapy inform the rest of the therapeutic work. We have found that it can be really especially helpful when people are kind of locked in there's a sense of cognitive rigidity, patterns that people are stuck in, and having the ketamine can kind of help broaden horizons to think about things in a new way, create new ways that people can imagine being, find new resources within, sometimes spiritual resources or imaginal resources to help create something new, and also can provide kind of a sense of a reset or a shaking things up, or a time out of ordinary reality that gives you a different perspective. And one other thing just to say about it is that I think some people practice ketamine-assisted psychotherapy as sort of a standalone thing. Like you sign up to see that person and you'll see them, you know, six times and have six ketamine sessions. And the way I've been practicing it is more integrating it into longer-term therapy as a way of deepening and widening that process.
Susanna, can you give us an idea of what it might look like in the room with you doing ketamine-assisted psychotherapy?
Well, in the world we are living in right now, I have not had to bring it up to anyone. I think everybody brings it up. They, you know, people are reading about it in the news. And I'm a fairly cautious clinician, so I'm not an evangelizer. I'm not sort of bringing it up to everyone. Uh-huh. But when people have brought it up and asked about it, I've sort of let on, yes, I'm trained in this and I can support you in it. And, you know, I think that, again, there are practitioners who are doing it once a week or twice a week. The way that I've been using it with folks is more like once a month to have a deep, really deep, long session. We've actually had the privilege of getting to also do some of that work together where you can have both of us in the room at the same time, but to have a really deep session where new themes come up, new imagery comes up, new perspectives come up, and then you might meet 2 days later again or meet you know, the week later at the regular therapy time and be curious about how that's been impacting the week in between, how the person's been engaging with that work. And my experience has been that it's really opened up new worlds of exploration for people, like been able to help them go, oh, this is something, maybe this is a trauma that felt too scary to touch before we did this work. But in this work, I felt like I could touch the trauma and really be with it in a different way, or something that might feel more mundane, like, oh, we're doing this work and it made me realize that I actually want to take care of myself a little bit better. And so I want to make sure that I go outside once a day and get the sun on my face, or I want to make sure I go to bed on time every night. It's sort of always a beautiful mystery where things go.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when the client has had the ketamine-assisted therapy session and they've made these discoveries – in the moment, how do you keep it integrated outside of session?
I mean, besides having more therapy sessions to continue working with it, we'll often really suggest that people journal, that people do art. And then another big piece is actually letting some important people in their life know that they're doing this work and kind of establishing who are going to be safe people to talk to about it, and then letting those people know ahead of time how they can be supportive, how they can talk to that person about it so that they can feel really supported. And sometimes people have a tendency to want to tell everybody about it, and then it can feel like overwhelming, like they gave some of their magic away a little bit. And so we're kind of just teaching people how to get support and integrated into their families, their friends. Another big one would be nature, I think. Spending time in nature is always a wonderful integration tool.
Okay.
I might jump in here and add additionally that one thing that I know Susanna and I have both tried to emphasize when we work with the ketamine with our patients and clients is to clear space around the experience. And both of us have a lot of clinical experience working with specifically mothers with young children, for whom that prescription is especially difficult, if not impossible. It feels impossible for them to clear meaningful space around the experience. So I make it part of the prescription of the treatment that if we're going to do this, you are going to clear space. You are not going to have significant obligations on the day of the treatment or the evening after the treatment. You are not going to try to go back to work. You are not going to try to attend a Zoom meeting. You are not going to cook dinner for your family. All these things allow for what we were just talking about, which is cementing some of the new insights or perspectives that might have come up that day in the treatment, and allowing space for them to congeal and gel and take form as journaling or talking to a friend you haven't talked to in a long time. If you're called to do that, you have the space and time to do it because you've made that allowance for yourself. If you haven't made that allowance for yourself, it can really get lost, and the whole experience becomes less meaningful.
It's like clearing space around the experience before, obviously during, and after.
And after.
I love that for a lot of things. Thank you.
And I might add, you know, part of if we can add in to think a little bit about traditional plant medicines and sort of indigenous traditions around those, people will clear time before and after where there's some withdrawal from day-to-day life, sometimes different practices that people won't engage in. And specifically now, even asking people like to be really mindful about what media even they're connecting with and consuming with before and after that experience. So certainly I'm not really in the habit of asking people like, don't watch any TV or look at social media or any of these things before and after, but inviting people to think about how might those things have an effect on your journey, both if you do them beforehand and your ability to integrate if you jump right back into your phone immediately after, and just to ask people to set some intentions around that.
It's just, I think, such an important point for ketamine-assisted psychotherapy and for a lot of things.
Yeah.
Just being in self-preservation, because it sounds like you could be opened up a lot more than usual.
Yes. Very energetically vulnerable.
Energetically vulnerable. I love that. And Suzanne, I heard you say something that I thought was a really cool thing. you said something about imaginal resources. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? I think I know, but
people get a lot of archetypal imagery often. Sometimes it's imagery of ancestors, sometimes imagery of groups. There's animals, nature, fractals, shapes, colors. Sometimes people don't have visuals, so there's more emotions that come up for people, or like a phrase that they heard over and over in it, or a sense that they got to visit a certain place or person. And then that imagery can become a touchstone and a resource that people have back when they're in ordinary reality.
Mm, very cool. Thank you. Miriam, what about the role of the medical doctor in ketamine-assisted therapy?
So ketamine remains a controlled substance. It requires a prescription if you are going to use it outside of a hospital anesthetic kind of a use. So people who are working with it in psychotherapy need to have it prescribed by someone who has the credentials to write that prescription. So that could be a medical doctor, a nurse practitioner. And different states have, you know, varying laws about that. But that's one role for the medical doctor. And ideally, the medical doctor who prescribes it will be doing some kind of an assessment with the individual who is planning to take this medicine and making sure that they don't have any medical contraindications to taking the medicine, you know, that they don't experience, you know, significantly high blood pressure problems. I always want to know that people, if they have any thyroid abnormalities, that those are managed with medication, managed appropriately. It's a very safe medicine, so there aren't a whole lot of rule outs that would make the medicine completely contraindicated for somebody. It's used in much bigger doses safely in hospitals all the time as an anesthetic in both pediatric and adult populations. But nonetheless, this has to be prescribed either in its oral form, or if it's being injected or used in an IV form, that has to be prescribed by a clinician.
Can I just jump in and say also, I think that the medical professional is a therapeutic presence, and certainly you are a wonderful therapeutic clinician.
Oh, thank you, Susanna.
And you hold, yeah, you
I'm
hold
not just
psycho-
the prescriber.
Spiritual space. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah. I mean, my relationship with this medicine so far is that I came to it with curiosity because I've been a psychiatrist for 15 years-ish and working in a more traditional way with the medicines that we have to treat depression and anxiety and other significant mental illnesses. And from what I've seen of this medicine so far, I don't like separating myself out as a prescriber of the medicine, except when I'm collaborating with excellent psychotherapists like Susanna Neufeld, in which case sometimes I will prescribe medicine to her clients and then she does the psychotherapy with them in her office. Another way I'm working with it is prescribing it to my own patients and doing the sitting with the medicine experience with them, which involves psychotherapy support throughout. And I really, really get a lot out of that experience. And then we continue to do the psychotherapy integration work that you were just speaking of earlier.
How long would a session be?
I think if you ask people who are doing this work, the traditional, most would say 2 to 3 hours, because, well, from my perspective, if you're using it in a psychotherapeutic framework to augment psychotherapy, there needs to be time both at the beginning of the session and as you come off and out of the medicine experience to prepare beforehand and then to integrate and start to be curious about the experience after it's occurred. And all of that requires time. The medicine is active in one's body for about 45 minutes or an hour, depending on how you metabolize the medicine, sometimes also depending on the dose of the medicine you've received. And you just want to allow time before and after for paying attention to the mindset or the intention that the person is bringing into the medicine experience. Maybe getting that articulated so that it's formally acknowledged by both the therapist and the person about to have this experience. It seems to kind of honor the power of the medicine a little bit more.
Oh, I like that.
You know, well, uh-huh. It does, because it is powerful. This mm-hmm. is a powerful experience, and I think we owe it that. If I don't know how else to say it, that it to set the stage for a powerful experience helps to contextualize it a little bit, and then you can check in afterwards and sort of wonder together, how did our intention actually play into the experience? Did you actually let go of the intention completely and go somewhere else unexpected? Or do we have some new insight about the thing that you were initially wondering about or struggling with? There's just so many places to go, but it's nice to have that as a launching point.
Okay, so first, I've never done a psychedelic, and so it sounds to me like very out of control. Mm-hmm. So what if I did let myself be out of control and I got like weird in the setting with the two of you? First of all,
that sounds like a great time.
Yeah. I'm like, I don't plan on doing it with the two of you, okay? Because then it would be a little weird. Hi, Susanna. But like, what? How does that go?
Well, I just want to say before you answer that question, or whoever answers the question, that's a question that most clients would ask, right?
Okay.
And so actually, that there begins the therapy is the relational piece here of what is it
yes.
like to be that vulnerable and possibly out of control with another person here?
Yes.
And what are your fears about what I'll think of you? And what are your fears? What in your life does that remind you of? There's so much. How much is that a core fear for everyone? What if I lose control in some way in my life?
Right.
The first woman I treated, and I shared with her, I said, you're the first person I'm treating, someone who I've worked with for a long time. And one of the first things she said was, I'm afraid I'll do something silly.
So yeah, the question was really coming up very big for me. I'm like, yeah. How do I ask this? But I'm glad to hear that that is a normal question.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the answer is, I hope that a grounded clinician would be A, you know, getting a lot of training and support and consultation and resource in themselves doing their own work, that they would be able to say, and this is my hope, that we'd be able to say, you are welcome to show up as you are, and you might feel embarrassed about it before or after, and to talk about like here are going to be how I'll, you know, if the boundary has to be put there, if you do something, I need to keep you safe. Here's how we'll do it. And here's how we'll communicate. And let's figure that all out between us ahead of time. But to really invite people to be in a self-compassionate state and curious state and a state of openness, and to definitely let someone know that I welcome them however they are.
It does seem to tie in really nicely about how you both stated up front that it's usually with people you have that rapport with to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so then it leads to my next question. Miriam, is ketamine considered to be a psychedelic?
I would say without a doubt, yes. If we talk about psychedelics as molecules that bring one into an altered state of consciousness out of usual mind and into a subjectively very different state of mind in which one could experience visual hallucinations, you know, and or a warping of sense of time and space that is very much a departure from one's regular experience of the world. So another way of saying this is maybe you've heard lately a lot of talk about the default mode network, which is sort of neurobiologically like the way our brains are used to operating, the circuitry that's established that determines kind of how we sense ourselves in time and space and perceive ourselves in relation to others. Some of this is taken offline with ketamine and allows for this very different experience of consciousness in which one perceives oneself very differently, if at all. One might completely lose a sense of oneself. And I've heard people describe themselves as atoms or as a shape or something really unexpected or unusual. And often with the ketamine experience, sometimes people forget about their bodies and they have sort of a release or an experience of forgetting about their earthbound forms and kind of journeying somewhere else in some other form. So most definitely, we would call it a psychedelic.
I like the way that sounds.
Signe, may I just say, I think your journey has already begun.
I'm sort of feeling the same way. This might turn out a little differently today than we thought. We might be here a while, 2 to 3 hours. But I like that losing the sense of, how did you say it, Miriam? Losing your sense of...
Your earth, did you say?
Your earthbound form.
Your earthbound form. I'm like, wow.
Your meat suit.
Your meat suit.
Your meat suit.
You definitely can lose your meat suit.
I like it. I like it.
You can feel like, when you said Adam, like also like just like a pure soul.
People have so many textured and different experiences, but a shared sense that they've been in a very different place and consciousness. Mm. And some of this depends on the dose of the medicine, which is an important feature of ketamine. We can adjust the dose to have sort of lighter, gentler experiences in which the person is still pretty much, quote unquote, in the room, mm-hmm. and just a little bit open and loosened and able to still talk to the therapist and have a back and forth that is coherent. Mm-hmm. And then at bigger doses, people can experience what we might call ego dissolution, a complete departure from their body and a sense of being in the room that they're in, and a sense of being in a completely different reality or dimension in which everything about their life here in this dimension is forgotten. Or very, very, very distant.
Okay.
It's also the route of administration and the setting of like how you're setting it up. I mean, mm-hmm. I've often have people who have told me, not clients, just people in the world who've told me that they've used ketamine as a recreational drug, and they're like, how is it different, you know, in an office setting?
So different.
So, and yeah. In an office setting, you're lying down, you have an eye mask on, so you're really encouraged. There's music. You're really encouraged to have an inner journey. I imagine it would be very different than
using
at a party.
It recreationally.
Yeah.
I'm glad you asked that question, because I was going to try to find a way to bring it in. Yeah. Wasn't sure.
I mean, I think there's people who really love it as a party drug, but I think that you know, having the frame of the processing before and after and the integration can take something that could be fun and make it deeply meaningful. Mm. One thing they both can have in common, you know, I don't know if you've heard people talk about like the K-hole. You know, when people talk about doing it recreationally, they're wanting to avoid the K-hole. And I think that in a way, what's happening in a therapy setting is you're actually embracing the K-hole, diving into the K-hole and seeing what's there when you practice letting go.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think one thing that's coming up with this piece of our conversation is that the ketamine experience is never predictable. Yeah. Mm. And even if you adjust the dose and tweak to, you know, whatever customized dose you want, you can have varied experiences every single time. Same person, same therapist, same room, and have really different experiences every time with the medicine. And Susanna and I have talked about this at length. The experiences can be everything in the range or wheel of beautiful, mystical, embodied to dark, disturbing, difficult, and challenging. And that's a really important thing to know going in. And part of the preparation is understanding that and being ready for that and curious about that possibility.
So it's part of the informed consent?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And the skill building, right? Like what are your, mm-hmm. in a way, like what are your navigational tools when something scary happens, when there's inner monsters that come up? I think also this might be a place to say, you could think about some of the different populations that this might be useful for. Anyone who has kind of a fear of parts of themselves that are out of control or that has part fear of a darkness within or anxiety and things like that, that the ability to practice letting go and facing these things, right? It's like almost a form of exposure therapy.
It's sounding like that. And it sort of sounds like the work you're doing ahead of time is sort of like a cope ahead that you might do for an exposure therapy.
Yeah.
Speaking of the types of conditions that you might use ketamine for, can we go a little further into what that might look like?
I don't have the research in front of me. I know that what it's been studied for, and so we could, you know, find references for it, is for treatment-resistant depression. What we haven't talked about that much is that the after effect of ketamine is that it's a pretty potent antidepressant and can work for people for whom most of the more conventional prescriptions maybe perhaps aren't as efficacious for. So treatment-resistant depression would be one.
And may I just tack on suicidal thinking is there's a significant evidence base for ketamine being able to reduce suicidal ideation.
How?
So I think it's part of that sort of cognitive reset that we were talking about, where things get shaken up. Even this is separate, by the way, from psychotherapy effect. It's independent of that. We know that there's something about brain exposure to ketamine that allows for a shifting of cognitive rumination. People who are stuck in a rigid mode of thinking, my sense is that it has to do with that's how it sort of shifts people, because it's quick and somewhat dramatic in terms of the way it can do that. That doesn't necessarily have a durable effect. So it's not like you do that once and you never have suicidal thoughts again. It means that for a few days that your thinking has shifted and your suicidal ideation is reduced.
Which then you have room, you have maybe more room to be present, to show up, to get help from your therapist, your psychiatrist, your team, your family, whoever it is.
For the suicidal ideation to remit and lift off for a little bit, it's not necessarily dependent on how they handle the actual ketamine.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
It's not dependent.
It's not that like they have to do that right.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And, okay. Oh, it's so, I'm so glad you said that, because this is a message I do try to deliver over and over again. I probably sound like a broken record with some of my patients but that there is no right way to do this medicine. That
okay.
There is, now that's when we're talking about the experiential psychotherapy version of treatment with this medicine. There's no right way to do it. And therefore, every encounter with it can be different and made useful, whether it was subjectively positive or sort of happier experience or a more challenging and difficult experience. They're all of value, and there's no right or wrong way to do it.
I will say, I think that it's also a thing that I hear all the time from people when they're having their journey. They'll go, am I doing this right? Or what if I didn't? Or sometimes people have a big experience one time and then a really mild experience the next time, and they think, was one right and was one wrong? I think a lot of the work is what happens around that.
Okay.
Right,
oh,
like,
I see.
Right, like what's making you ask that question?
Yeah.
Where's that coming from, that perfectionism?
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
The idea that we're all supposed to perform a certain way, and that if you do perform a certain way, you're going to get some outcome.
Okay.
I think some of the people coming in loaded with that has to do in a way with how popular psychedelics are in the media right now. Mm-hmm. There's so much hype and excitement. And in a way, you know, I think I'm excited too about it. And I think that the way it gets talked about is like, it's going to be this amazing thing that you do one time and then your whole life of conditioning is now cured. You have no more struggles. And I think that a lot of what we're doing actually is helping people with their expectations, with the pressure they're putting on themselves and the experience, and knowing that there's so much magic with this, but there's no magic in terms of like, this is now going to cure you forever. Like, we still have to do the really hard work of being a human being here on this planet, and growth is not something that happens in, you know, one ketamine session or 30 ketamine sessions. Like, it's a long, it's a lifelong journey, not one short journey.
Yeah. And the tiny bit that I read about before the two of you coming in, it did definitely, you can kind of see your mind doing a little bit of magical thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anytime people throw the word transformative or transformation in there, I think understandably people get excited about it and
sure.
expectations are built. And,
okay. So we've talked about ketamine-assisted psychotherapy for depression and things like suicidal ideation. What other conditions have you been using it for?
So I'll just speak for some of the things that I've seen it be helpful for with people. There's trauma history, PTSD, anxiety, and perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. I don't think you can do it when you're pregnant, actually.
No,
during pregnancy, but certainly for postpartum, it can be used. But one of the applications that I'm the most excited about is using it with people with eating disorders to help, particularly with rigid thinking and some of that perfectionism, and open up a world of practice of letting go, practice of delight in self, practice of facing one's fears, letting go of judgment. I'm really intrigued. We don't have a ton of data on this, but I think there's, based on, you know, the folks I've been privileged to work with it, I think there's a lot of potential.
And specifically with eating disorders, as Susanna was mentioning, we know that cognitive rigidity is a feature. And so a patient of mine recently said, "I feel like the furniture in my head just got moved around." And I thought, yeah. So if the furniture in your brain needs moving around, you need a little renovation or a complete gut renovation, this medicine can allow for that. And I'll also add that in terms of people who, you know, experience different struggles psychiatrically, there's one that's not in the DSM, but that I tell people that this medicine can be helpful for, and it is stuckness. It's not a diagnosis. It's not in our, you know, Bible of diagnostic categories, but it moves something. There's movement there's movement where there hasn't been movement in a long time.
It reminds me a little bit of the, not fight or flight, but the freeze. Okay. Very, very cool. Miriam, for ketamine assisted psychotherapy with eating disorders specifically, does an individual need to be weight restored? Are there any prerequisites?
I'll just start answering by saying I think it's really, really important that any clinician who prescribes ketamine for someone who is actively being treated for an eating disorder collaborate with the whole team. So okay. I like the idea of a team approach in which person has been medically cleared.
This
work. Absolutely. I would never prescribe to someone who hadn't, you know, been seen, you know, for a recent physical exam and stable vital signs, that kind of thing.
Well, let me just say one thing about why I brought in, I mentioned weight restored specifically because of what I know about medication in general, not necessarily being so beneficial at a quote unquote underweight. And when I say underweight, I mean underweight for that individual in that individual's history of weight. So
I am always really careful on podcasts to not talk about any of my individual clients, because it feels like such tender work. But I will say that my experience has been that I have seen people who are really at a low with their eating disorder in terms of behaviors have quite a lot of benefit in a way that actually gives them resources that has helped them restore.
I see.
So again, it's really like only anecdotal from my experience, but I have not seen the same thing that, you know, we see with people not necessarily benefiting as much from an SSRI when they're at a low for them place. The bigger concern I have is that I have seen it used. You know, there are a lot of opportunities at the moment, although I just saw that the law may change around this, but for people to use kind of these online services where they can maybe briefly meet with a doctor and then be prescribed ketamine to use by themselves at home, or they're instructed to sit with a sitter, a friend, or a family member who can sit with them. And there's lots of debate and thought to be had about, you know, how that provides more access to this, certainly. And also then people aren't necessarily getting that therapeutic piece, and there's a lot of feelings of being alone. There's a lot that's very complicated about it. But a downside with eating disorders that I have witnessed is that, you know, frequently there's a pattern with eating disorders where someone will restrict their intake during the day. And then if they have binging behaviors, have that happen later in the day. And, you know, as you know, Signe, sometimes one of the things that really helps people stabilize their eating patterns during the day is wanting to avoid to binging is the part that's aversive, right? And so they'll often be more willing to engage in regular, stable eating patterns to prevent that binge behavior from happening later. And I have seen where ketamine's possibly overprescribed, where then people are using it kind of as a way to not binge, which is taking away the motivation then to make sure you're not restricting. And then people are really locked in a cycle where they're dependent on the ketamine to kind of help them stay stuck in their eating disorder. So these are things that I think as this comes out of its infancy, this field, you know, I think that will be a really important thing for people to start thinking about how the prescribing practices go for doing this at home, and taking into account eating disorder specific ways in which it could make that go awry.
Okay. So it's like if it's misused, it can turn into an avoidance behavior?
I think it can. And I think that we also know there are some stories of people certainly abusing ketamine. I never want to make it seem like ketamine is this non-risky thing. I think that there are risks that are associated with it. And so it's really important to go in, if you're turning to this as a avenue for healing, to, I think what Miriam said earlier about, I can't remember how you said it, but something about really respecting this molecule and honoring its power. Mm-hmm. Like, I have a lot of reverence for how, in a way, sacred the experience is. And I think with many sacred medicines, if they're used without the mindfulness and the intention around them, they can be abused.
Okay.
I think I'd like to add that it doesn't work for everybody. Mm-hmm. And that in my practice so far, again, anecdotal, I would say 70% where I felt like something really useful happened. And then more disappointing experiences for people, which I do try to prepare people for, you know, that it's not always going to be something that we can both look at and say with confidence, this was a really fruitful intervention. I would say certainly most of the time, that's how it's gone for me so far. But in a minority of cases, there are people we call non-responders. And so I just wanted to mention that to kind of temper all the, I know we've talked today with a lot of enthusiasm and described some really remarkable aspects of the medicine. And there's also, you know, a chance that someone could be, as we call it, you know, a non-responder.
Okay.
I really would encourage anyone engaging with ketamine or other psychedelic medicines to do so within the container of a caring relationship, to make sure you have good, solid support with someone you feel safe with, for your practitioner or your team, to not feel like you have to, you know, go it alone, but to know that all kinds of stuff can come up and it can be a journey. It's journey is the only word for the trip. Both of these things, they're common sayings for a reason. That it is, you're embarking on something where there are many rewards but challenges along the way. So,
yeah.
Well, Susanna and Miriam, thank you so much for coming in here and for your willingness to explore ketamine-assisted psychotherapy and for giving hope to those who have not found relief with therapy or medication alone. I just really appreciate the work you're doing and the bravery around it. It is exciting, but I like how you said it's exciting and we also need to balance it with the realism.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And feel free to contact me at www.signadarpinian.com. See you next month.